Social Justice News Journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco for August 25, 2005. Today, a conversation with Dexter Kamelevich, a Maine father whose son is bravely speaking out about the conditions he and the other troops are really facing in Iraq. Ben Kamelevich is a world-class biathlete who hoped to be on the U.S. team at the 2006 Olympics. When he was recruited by the Vermont National Guard to be on their biathlon team pre-9/11, he never thought that he'd find himself a few years later, poorly trained and badly equipped, fighting a war in Iraq. But since he was sent there in July of this year, he and his family, who live in Oars Island, Maine, have been doing everything they can to call attention to what's really happening in Iraq. We spoke earlier today with his father, Dexter Kamelevich. What's going through your mind as your son, who was supposed to be a biathlete and just, you know, doing a weekend stint in the Vermont National Guard, is suddenly facing going to Iraq?
Well, it's very interesting. Sometime in January, I began to think about that subject as a parent of a son going to Iraq, and at that particular time, it began to become obvious that there were questions about whether or not the reasons that we were there were legitimate. But I really was very, very concerned about Ben, both in terms of having to go and be exposed to being killed, but also the effects of having to go to Iraq and being put in the position to kill somebody and what effects that would have on him. I lived through the Vietnam War and saw the results of the tremendous pressures that were brought upon those soldiers, and it scared me to death. And I tried to relieve my mind by trying to put it down on paper, and I was struck by the fact that I could not express to my friends that Ben was going to Iraq. I didn't know what to say. And then I began to worry about him personally. I knew that that this potential for his death was really very, very serious problem. And then I began to hear all of the news that was coming out of Iraq from soldiers that were there. It was pretty clear that there were real troubles in terms of providing personal armor, the Kevlar armor, and that many people were buying armor for their soldiers, in spite of the fact that the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, said that they did not have it in stock. And there were problems with the up-armored Humvees. And these kinds of things worried me for his safety's sake more than anything else. And I wrote an op-ed piece that ended up in, of all days, February 14th, Valentine's Day, in the Portland Press Herald. And it was a piece that really questioned whether or not there was a real level of support for our troops, and particularly from the point of view of those who were sending our troops to Iraq. And it was at that time that we knew that 1,400 people had been killed. We knew that there were 10,000 people who had been wounded or maimed, not including the psychological damage that had been done on our troops. And there were various estimates, up to 100,000 of the Iraqi people who were also being killed. These were many, many more times than those who were killed or maimed in the World Trade Center, and it confounded me. I did not understand why we were going down that path, and why was Ben being put in that position. It's really interesting because shortly thereafter, Ben, who was having questions of his own in Mississippi, wrote a 5-page letter to Senator Susan Collins of the state of Maine, his congressman, the congressman he grew up with, the congress that he grew up with, representing him at least in Maine. And he brought to her attention a significant number of inadequacies that he felt it was necessary. He was not whining about going to Iraq. He was basically being very careful about saying, you know, things aren't what you think they are. And he pointed out that he had no personal armor, and there was no indication that personal armor would, in fact, be coming to him. And this is after 3 years of being in the midst of this war, which to him seemed ludicrous, as well as ludicrous to the rest of us. They were not working with up-armored Humvees at all. Their Humvees were stripped of all armor, and so they were not being trained, really, to do a mission in a way to prepare them for that mission. They had Vietnam-era weapons which were falling apart in their hands. They were being trained by people who had been pulled back into the service, officers who were out of the area of artillery. Ben is in an infantry, a mobile infantry unit. And these people had never been to war, and in fact, their backgrounds were one, I believe, was a cook, and one was a dietitian, and they did not know how to train these soldiers, and were basically putting them in a position of going unprepared to war. There were all kinds of other things. There were pay problems that people were having. And what this really amounted to in terms of Ben was a tremendous abandonment by the country, by the people who are charged with the responsibility of preparing troops to go to war. And that confounded him, and that certainly confounds me to this very day as well, because there's an enormous amount of evidence that the military has abandoned the troops. It's not the people that abandoned the troops. And that really brings up this whole business of the questioning of the war in Iraq, the questioning of the support of the troops is not meant not to support the troops. In fact, it's much the opposite. And I think that we've all been given a line that just doesn't hold water, and that is you can be against the war, you can question about the support of the troops, and you can still be in supporting the troops yourself. And that's the kind of questioning that Ben was bringing to bear. Senator Collins went to work along with Senator Snow from Maine to ask questions about why this condition existed. And in fact, in April, a letter came from Deputy Chief of Staff of the Department of the Army on April 8th to Senator Snow, from Vicki L. Dunn, a Ph.D., outlining that there were concerns about some of the training. There were certainly concerns about some of the armoring, but there were indications that this would all be taken care of by the time that they went to Iraq. And it was shortly before that that my wife and I actually had dinner with a group of peace activists up in Bath with Cindy Sheehan, who was at that point yet to have her first year anniversary of her son Casey's death. And it was remarkable because her son went as a Marine to Iraq and was killed within, I believe, 2 weeks, but very early in his deployment to Iraq. And he died in a Humvee that didn't have armoring, and he was put into a mission that they were not trained for. And that haunted both my wife Gretchen and I very, very much. And we continued to ask enormous numbers of questions of our congressional delegation to try to see what sense that we could make out of all of this. And frankly, all we got was assurances that everything would be okay, and that the reasons for the war were still substantiated. They had changed a bit. Now the reasons for continuing in this war was that it did free the Iraqis from Saddam Hussein, and that now, just because we made a mistake or may have made a mistake going into the war, we couldn't desert the Iraqis. And that seemed terribly thin to us, in spite of the tremendous facts that were being given by Ben in terms of the support for this war, which just didn't seem to hold up.
You mean the support that he was seeing actually from the Iraqis, or the lack of support that he was seeing from the Iraqis?
I think it was. You have to remember, this is a very small world, and many of the people that he knew really all over the world with skiing with military people that he did get reports on a first-hand basis of what was happening. And many of those reports seem to indicate that he should not expect any support in terms of up-armored equipment and the kind of things that you send soldiers to war with, which he began to question as being a result, really, of really not supporting the war itself by the people who had created the war. And that confounded him. And he found out later that, at least where he is, in the Sunni Triangle, that there's a significant amount of evidence in both in terms of the Iraqi people themselves and the reaction that he has had in a very short time, and continuing deficiencies in the support by the military of our troops that really place our troops in a position of not only great danger, but in positions of making terrible decisions that do affect the Iraqi people themselves. And that's what he finally discovered. Those fears were made real for him. And on August 8th, he provided another letter to the office of Senator Snow at the request of Jay Cummings, one of her staff members in Washington. Jay Cummings had called me asking about Ben's experiences in Iraq based on some letters that I had written to the congressional delegation. And I said, well, you know, why are you just talking with me? Why don't you talk with Ben directly and find out for yourself? And he said, well, can I do that? And I said, sure, here's his email address. And he emailed Ben, and Ben, on August 8th, he'd been there in late July, Ben provided a very detailed list of the kind of things that Ben was being confronted with. He was working 12-hour days in 120 to 130-degree temperatures, and since he had been there for over 30 days, he had had one day off. You have to remember that Ben is a world-class athlete. He can ski 50 kilometers and then the next day go out and do it again. I know in my conversations with Ben, he sounded like a drunken person. He slurred his words. He could not really function because of the tremendous long hours and the stress. And the stress came from really a very interesting set of circumstances. One is that he was provided with a Humvee that had no armor at all. In fact, there were bullet holes through it. It had been in its third; it was going into its third tour, and it was broken. There were cuts in it from flak that they had received from shrapnel. The turret upon which there's a 50 caliber machine gun would not operate properly, and that's pretty critical if you are going to be in a military situation. And the other thing that really came to the fore is that he began to communicate with Iraqis, albeit from far away. And he said it was extremely clear, based on the hate in the eyes of the Iraqis, that we were not welcomed in the Sunni Triangle, which is where the significant portion of the population is. In fact, on numerous occasions, people would yell out to the soldiers, go home, go home. And the reasons are really simple. What he found was a city where the sewage ran free in the streets and smelled like an open sewer all of the time. There was no electricity, no consistent electricity being provided to the local population. Potable water was extremely difficult to get a hold of. And more importantly, in some respects, there was no economy. He had the fortune to meet a son of a neighbor of ours from Orr's Island who said that when they came a year before, there was a prosperous little market that was operating. It no longer existed, and there was no work. The unemployment in these areas is near total. these people have no way to support their families. And in fact, Ben and his soldiers were detained, some Iraqis who were then turned over for interrogation. And when he talked with the interrogators later, he asked about them, and he said they admitted to digging holes for IEDs, the improvised explosive devices by the side of the road that are so deadly to our troops. And the reason that they gave was, we have no work. We have to feed our children, and we get paid to do that, and we do it. These are not the stories that we are now getting out of Iraq. In fact, from all of the managed activities of the press and the administration, we hear delightful bucolic stories about all of the Iraqis who love us. Well, it's pretty clear that that's not the case. It's and how anybody can try to sustain that kind of picture of Iraq is well beyond me. Nobody really cares about the Iraqis. In fact, nobody really cares about our troops in Iraq, insofar as I can see. I think that one of the things that really got me last night as I watched television on a business trip, I saw the president talk about the tremendous need for service and sacrifice and the appreciation for that service and that sacrifice. And it struck me as being extraordinarily empty. There are women who go and serve and sacrifice in Iraq, and the president's two daughters don't serve or sacrifice in Iraq. In fact, I would tell you that the Bushes do not serve and do not sacrifice anything. In fact, what they've really done across the board is to go and take our troops and use them essentially as indentured servants. There are people who have, for the third time, been recycled in Iraq as soldiers, operating under enormous pressures, daily being subject to being shelled and being shot at, and this happens for the course of a year, and they get sent home for 3 months and are diagnosed with a post-traumatic stress syndrome, and then within 3 months they're activated again to do it again. And part of what's happening here is that what we have is not a volunteer army. As Senator Snow, I met with Senator Snow last week, and I said, Senator Snow, if 80% of the country will not support a draft, what does that tell you? It tells you that they don't want this war, and they certainly don't want to put their sons and daughters and husbands and wives and brothers and sisters in harm's way. They just don't support this war, and they don't support it by huge, huge margins. So I said, then what do we do? Because according to General McCafferty, a retired general of the Marines, said after Bush's speech at Fort Bragg, that there is no way in September of 06 that we could sustain replacing those troops with what we have. And her answer to me was that what we have is a volunteer army, and that they needed to find a way to make sure that that volunteer army worked. And I asked her if she understood stop-loss, the concept of stop-loss. What that means is that when you have gone through the period of your service to your country and you have made all of your complete obligation, that you can be held in the Army under the law supported by the Congress of the United States for a further tour. And what they can do is they can look at you in the eye and they can say, you know, you've got two choices. You can take your bonus, and we'll send you to Iraq. Or you can refuse your bonus and refuse to re-up, but we'll send you to Iraq anyway. I do not know how any parent in this country can live with the fact that we are recycling troops two and three, and maybe we'll have to do it four times, exposing our sons and daughters to hours and hours and hours of incredible stress in the Sunni Triangle, and not support them. Last Friday, the 16th of August, I received a call at work from my daughter-in-law, Sarah. And my daughter-in-law said, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, "What's the matter, Sarah?" And she said, "Ben has been involved in a firefight." And it just struck me right between the eyes. And I said, "What happened?" And she said, "He's okay." What happened is that three men and one Humvee set up an observation post on a busy road. And somewhere down a mile or more is another observation post in which there is one other Humvee with three people. And going between them is a third Humvee that supports the both of them. On that particular day, Ben pulled over, motioned a white van to pull over so that they could be inspected. And as Ben was going over to that white van, a man came out of the white van with an AK-47 spraying the countryside with bullets. Ben was in the situation where there were bullets whining past his head. He could feel them in the air. He could see them. And he reached for a pistol, a handgun, which he had, and he shot the man. No sooner had he done that, then out of the back of the van came six more doing the same thing. And he and another sergeant, the two men on the ground, shot at them and forced them back toward the van. And then they made their way back to the Humvee. And upon them being visible to the 19-year-old private sitting up on top of the Humvee, who held his fire because his two men were in the line of fire, he was then able to open fire. That dispatched the six Iraqis. It blew the van up and started a tremendous fire. It was full of munitions. Basically, what really had happened is that Ben had come as close to dying as anybody could possibly come. And I have a real serious problem with that. There should be more people there in Iraq if they're going to go and pursue this war. But I don't think that there's ever any intention by this administration or even the Congress of the United States to really be concerned about that, because they're not connected with it. They don't have children over there. They do not have brothers and sisters over there. And I just don't think that that's right. There is no reason for us to be there. We're on the verge of a civil war. What we could have is a situation like Saigon, where we have to go and ferry those people out. But I can tell you that there is nothing more frightening and nothing more depressing than getting a telephone call that tells you how close your child has come to dying, and especially in a situation that you can't support, and I can't. It's frightening beyond belief. And in this situation, it's going to happen over and over and over again. In fact, last night I received a call from my daughter-in-law saying that she had just received a call that one of Ben's fellow soldiers from Vermont had been killed. And that in that group, I believe that there are, which is made up of men and women from Vermont and from Pennsylvania, that there have been four Pennsylvanians that have been killed. And they've been there less than 2 months. And there are 11 months left to go. And it is just beyond me how we're going to all put up with that. I believe that what's happening here is that because so few people are directly connected to this, there are not being tough questions being asked of by our Congress, of the Department of the Army and the administration. And there are many questions that really do need to be asked about our presence in Iraq, including why we should be there, essentially putting our soldiers in the position of having to kill innocent Iraqis. And that's what's happening. And we need to call our congressmen and put that question to them in a serious way on a regular basis. We need to write to them and tell them how we feel. Or, in fact, we're really going to be putting ourselves in the position of just ignoring it like the Germans did in World War II. And that is unforgivable, in my opinion. My wife Gretchen and I consider ourselves to be very ordinary type of people. And we have worked very hard to try to understand this war in Iraq and understand why we are there and why we would continue to be there. And we cannot find any good reasons. We would have a much better understanding of being, frankly, in Saudi Arabia. But unfortunately, the Bushes are too much connected to Saudi Arabia. All you have to do is see the pictures of George Bush hand-in-hand with the king of Saudi Arabia. What we did find out is that people can make a difference. And Gretchen and I and many, many people get up every single day and try to make sure that we ask very tough questions and bring very clear examples of what's going wrong in Iraq to our congressmen. I believe, after having had a chance to read Abe Fortas's discussion of dissent and civil disobedience, that we are really at the point of being able to tell the Congress that they need to ask questions about whether this war is justified, whether our presence in killing people there does not, in fact, rise to crimes against humanity. There is no question in my mind that the tens of thousands of Iraqi citizens who have died are specifically the responsibility of George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and a small group of people in the administration. It's time for them to back away from these sins against humanity. And if the Congress continues in silence to vote for more appropriations and not to ask questions, they too are guilty of crimes against humanity. And these are based on facts that very simple, reasonable people have been able to ascertain by just asking questions. It's time for us to ask questions in public in the bright light of day. And that is what the democratic process is, whether we like it or whether we don't like it. This has nothing to do with Republicans and Democrats. This has to do with the democracy and the life of our sons and daughters and the lives of people who are totally innocent of what it is that they are being subject to. I believe that from my depths of my soul, the depths of my heart, and I can only hope that people can move themselves to do that themselves, to raise those questions.
That was Dexter Kemalevich of Oars Island, Maine. The Kemalevich family will be hosting Cindy Sheehan when she returns to Maine September 10th for a protest of the Blue Angels air show in Brunswick. Meanwhile, they worry about Ben every day. They say he's struggling with his feelings about being put in the position to have to kill someone last Friday. Ben has asked his family to send him and his buddies some very small soccer balls so they can throw them to the younger Iraqi children. They said not to bother sending the larger regulation-sized soccer balls because by the time the kids are old enough to use those, they're already firing at the Americans. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Joel Mann engineered today's program, and Andy Buckley does web and technical support. You can reach us here at WERU or by emailing radioactive@maineindymedia.org. Listen to our archived programs and also subscribe to our podcasting on our website, radioactivenews.org. Thanks for listening and acting. Stay tuned for more independent news on your community radio station, WERU, and join us again next Thursday at 4 for Radioactive.